Welcome to the primary edition of your local talking newspaper covering St Albans, Harpenden and all the villages within the district. I'm Barbara, one of today's readers. We hope you liked the piece of music that we just played. As always, our thanks go to Gough Beam Music, who has allowed us to use this piece of music. The news items come from this week's edition of the Hearts Advertiser. Here is my first news item. Troubled Winter Festival will not return to the city. Naysayers have won their campaign against St Albans Meraki Christmas Festival, which will not be returning for 2019. When St Albans District Council handed over the reins to its 2018 festive market, the event was welcomed with open arms by many residents and businesses. Previous year's offerings had racked up a bill of more than £300,000 since 2013 and never broken even. However, when Meraki applied for planning permission to erect a winter wonderland on Westminster Lodge Front Meadow, a handful of the site's neighbours took up arms to campaign against the event. Meraki organisers were forced to split it over three locations: the Vintry Garden, opposite Westminster Lodge, and at Hart's Showground, which closed early due to operational difficulties. The District Council eventually gave the go-ahead for the meadow site on December the 7th, leaving just one day for Meraki to set up shop before its opening night. There were funfair rides, children's ice skating, Santa's grotto, chalets, live music, and more space for socialising. However, after opening reviews were mixed and organiser Kerry Marks has now announced the Winter Wonderland would not be returning to St Albans for a second year. She said, "It's been pretty quiet here since the opening, unfortunately, so I don't think we'll be able to come back and do this one again. I have read social media reviews from some people and I'm sorry I haven't lived up to your expectations. To build this event in one day is pretty tough, and it meant we were not able to do everything the way we wanted it to be." On hearing the news, St Albans residents took to the Hearts Ads Facebook page to debate what went wrong. Luke Ridge thinks that St Albans District Council should have done more. "Meraki did the best they could with what they had, but to deal with St Albans Council is a horrific job. They are responsible for this festival's demise, not Kerry and Meraki. Nothing is simple. Everything is a pain with them. I'm not at all surprised it has ended like this." David Thurston agreed. "Why do councils pander to the minority moaners rather than giving the majority what they want? Meraki was set up to fail by this atrocious council." Andrew Jackson added, "What will people object to now if you don't come back next year? Some people are put on this earth to ruin every decent person's enjoyment." Charlotte Delcor added, "There's nothing wrong with the festival. It's amazing. However, I haven't seen any advertisements and it all seemed last minute. I felt sorry for all the little independent retailers when I visited." Hayley Higgins said individual events definitely needed to be run better. "The council really messed this up, and it would have been lovely to have it every year. It definitely had some teething issues, but even with our disappointments with certain events, we would have still gone back next year in the hope that those problems would have been sorted out. Local business just isn't meant to survive in St Albans, I guess." John Allen said, "This town is always held to ransom by the NIMBYs, who contribute nothing into our great city and spoil for the rest." The Summer Meraki Festival, which is a paid music weekend held at Hart's Showground, is still scheduled to go ahead from August 23rd to the 25th. Markets Project Manager at St Albans District Council, Liz Marcy, said, "We would like to thank Meraki for the hard work they put into their event. Meraki approached the council earlier in the year with a view to piloting their Christmas market. We'd worked with Meraki before, and we felt that many of the benefits of the St Albans Christmas Market could be achieved with enhanced aspects at reduced cost through a change of formats. It turned out to be a very difficult event for them, not least because of some opposition to the park location and the poor weather. We will review and take stock of St Albans Christmas events in the new year before we take any decisions about what we will do next year.
Hello, I'm Andy. This article is headlined Campaigners Call for New Hospital on Airfield Site. Campaigners calling for a new hospital central to St Albans, Watford and Decorum are urging the council to consider the former Radlett Airfield site for development. West Hearts Hospital Trust is undergoing a search for a potential new hospital site and has asked St Albans District Council to earmark provision for a new hospital in its local plan. Andy Love from the New Hospital Campaign said, "The former Radlett Airfield site is an ideal location for a new A&E hospital and also benefits from having a railway link to Watford Junction running close by to it. Very few publicly owned sites have such good connections with the neighbouring towns that make up West Hearts. Housing development and a new hospital would be an ideal combination to fund the infrastructure needed to serve both." Developers Helios Slough have been given permission to build a strategic rail freight interchange on the former airfield site, but a Hearts Ad poll in October suggested residents would prefer to see the site developed for housing. Andy said, "A new hospital will be cheaper than a redevelopment of the three existing hospital sites. We just need the landowners to actually say that they have available land and to work together with the trust." The New Hospital Campaign has long maintained that renovating the existing hospital services at Watford General will be insufficient to deal with the growing population and is not in an ideal location to serve the people of West Hearts. A Hearts County Council spokesman said, "The County Council's policy, established back in 2016, is that we have a strong preference not to see a change in the current Greenbelt status of this land or to dispose of it. However, if planning permission was to be granted for the hospital proposal and the County Council was to dispose of the site, it could be considered along with any other proposals which also have planning permission." West Hearts Hospital Trust has said it would like the St Albans local plan to include a general plan for a new hospital within the next 5 to 10 years. The Hospital Trust's submission to the council criticised the lack of a hospital focus in the existing local plan and said it did not recognise the value a new hospital would have to the local population.
Hello, I'm Christine, and my first article is headed "Housing Professionals Advise Donors Not to Give Tents to Homeless in the City Centre." Well-meaning residents have been giving out pop-up tents to some of St Albans' most vulnerable people. Recent weeks have seen an increase in people camping in the city centre. As the weather gets colder, concerned members of the public have handed out tents as a makeshift temporary housing solution. But District Council Head of Housing, Karen Dragovich, wants to deter the donations. "We're aware that some rough sleepers have been given tents by members of the public, and we appreciate that this is well meant and a caring gesture. We work in partnership with a number of charities, organisations and faith groups to assist rough sleepers, and the general advice is not to provide tents, as there are other, better ways to help." She added, "This includes directing rough sleepers to Open Door Night Shelter and Drop-In Centre. Here, rough sleepers are offered advice on housing, health and other issues and can undertake educational and training courses to put them on a new pathway. We spoke to shoppers in the city centre about the tent donations." Catherine Wellesby of London Road said, "I'm on the fence as to whether this is a good thing or not, to be honest. I have huge compassion for these people, but I wonder if by helping them, we are enabling them." Former homeless person Alan Howe, 54 of Riverside Road said, "I don't think the benefactors providing tents are enabling homelessness. It's more that they are giving them a survival tool." National homeless charity Crisis advise that the best thing you can do is to connect a street person with the homelessness services in their area. And Housing Portfolio Councillor Brian Ellis agrees. "The council has a statutory duty to house homeless people and put significant resources into this, supporting charities and providing temporary accommodation. There's no need for anyone to be rough sleeping in our district, but we cannot force people to use our facilities if they do not wish to. I understand the public's concern and generosity towards rough sleepers, but they need to be persuaded to use our facilities and obtain treatment where necessary."
Hello, my name's Lizanne, and my first article's headline is MP welcomes better funding for cops, but taxpayers will foot most of the bill. Harpenden MP Bim Afolami has welcomed £14.9 million of extra funding for Hearts Police, most of which will come from increasing taxes. "The government is increasing the grant it gives to police and is also allowing police and crime commissioners, who control their force's budget, to increase council tax by £24 a year for Band D households." Mr. Afolami said, "I am delighted police funding in Hertfordshire could increase by up to £14.9 million next year. The new funding will mean the police budget will increase in real terms next year and will be vital in tackling rural crime and ensuring we can protect police numbers. This funding meets the goal of the campaign I have been involved in to boost police funding. I will continue to push for further increases to police funding in Hertfordshire going forward. The government grant to the police will increase by £2.2 million, and an additional £2 million will go towards police pensions. However, the remaining £10.7 million is likely to be raised by increasing the police precept in Hertfordshire's council tax. A precept is a section of council tax given to organisations such as the police, district councils and parish councils, which can decide to increase their precept by raising council tax. Hertfordshire Police and Crime Commissioner David Lloyd said, "I welcome this increase in new funding for the Hertfordshire Police Force. It provides reassurance going forward and will allow us to tackle pressing issues such as rural crime and policing numbers. I will be making full use of the precept increase granted to us by the government this year, which will raise the majority of the new funding in Hertfordshire next year. This will mean I can continue to invest heavily in preserving and strengthening local policing. It will help to create a police force that is embedded in and supported by a community working together to cut crime." Despite saying he would make use of the allowed precept rise, Mr. Lloyd had previously asked in an open letter for the views of the Hertfordshire public to help him determine whether going ahead with the precept rise was the right decision or not.
Plungers splashing into 2019 smashed records by raising almost £10,000 for charities. Brave fundraisers kick-started 2019 by braving a very cold plunge. About 500 people turned up to watch and take part in the fourth annual St Albans Polar Bear Plunge on New Year's Day, which sees plucky jumpers leap into the 6 degrees C waters of the Sub Aqua Club outdoor pool on Cotton Mill Lane. The event was in aid of the Ollie Foundation, which means one life lost is enough. Earthworks St Albans and the Counselling Foundation, as well as the plunger's own sponsorship causes. It has smashed records by raising £9,600, and organiser Claire Sutty hopes that the total can reach £10,000 in a final push. She said it has blown last year's fundraising total out of the water. I just think the St Albans community is amazing, and everyone has been blown away by support for the event and amazing atmosphere there. Claire believes the knitted postbox toppers, which decorated Royal Mail letterboxes around St Albans, helped to raise the event's profile. It is the final year Claire will be organising the event, since it was set up by husband Ed in 2016, who was raising funds for Rennie Grove Hospice Care, Earthworks St Albans and Cancer Research UK with a trip to the North Pole. She is taking a step back because the family now live in Devon. Claire said, "It's quite a big thing for us to do, and while we love it, it's a massive thing to arrange. But I'm hoping other charities will take it on and continue to run this amazing event and raise lots of money in the community." Some plungers took to the dive in fancy dress, including Snow White, Batman, a penguin, couple of Santas, the Blues Brothers, and a Baywatch team who rescued an inflatable friend called Tony. Food was supplied by Shot on the Spot, and music was provided by Melanie Wall and Paul Davis. Lifeguards Abby and Joe kept everyone safe by jumping in themselves in the end. The Ollie Foundation coordinator Verity Bramwell said, "The 2019 plunge saw, in the grand scheme of things, practically tropical weather for the brave jumpers. But far more than that, it saw a community atmosphere that was magical to be part of. It really was a fundraiser for all the family. And we can't thank everyone enough for all the help that made it happen."
Teenager jailed for assault after fight where boy stabbed in Verulamium Park. A teenager has been sentenced to a year in prison for assaulting a boy in Verulamium Park in St Albans in a fight which resulted in another teenager being stabbed. The defendant, who was 15 at the time, was part of a group of boys who attacked a 16-year-old in the park on June the 15th as they celebrated the end of their GCSE exams. The victim was punched and kicked until he lost consciousness. When the victim's cousin, also 16, stepped in to defend him, one of the boys stabbed him in the stomach with a 10-inch knife. The defendant, who is now 16, appeared in court on Wednesday, December 19th, charged with assault for his role in beating the first victim unconscious. Abby Arnold, defending, said, "He was taken away from his family for 6 months and placed in a foster home a considerable distance away. I would submit that for a young man who is quite vulnerable, that was a significant punishment in itself. The foster home was horrendous. There were several children running around and there were dogs everywhere. He had nothing to do." The defendant submitted a letter to the judge expressing his own perspective on the assault, stating that he was sorry for his actions and had learnt a lot from this. Ms. Arnold said, "It's a heartfelt letter. It's a true reflection of how he feels. He clearly has challenges as far as his literacy goes, and he finds it extremely hard to express himself. He still has a lot of growing up to do, and he hasn't had the best start in life. He is a young man and still has his future ahead of him, and this really is the turning point for him. Since this offence, he's not committed any further offences. He has been seeking work and he's been making positive changes in his life." The defendant was previously convicted for battery and actual bodily harm, which occurred in 2016, and for burglary, which took place in 2017. Judge Michael Kay QC said, "A large number of students were gathered in Verulamium Park following the end of their GCSE exams. It should have been a time of celebration. There were anywhere between 60 and 100 teenagers gathered there. It was peaceful until a group of youths approached a young man because of some trivial dispute between him and a relative of the defendant. It does not matter a jot what's behind all of this. The group approached the victim, who was sitting with a number of other young people in a circle in the park. One of the group asked him to come over to some other area so they could have a chat with him. It was clearly a menacing approach. The group punched and kicked the boy in the head until his cousin intervened and was stabbed. The stabbing victim had to be airlifted to hospital for emergency surgery to repair his gallbladder and stomach, and also suffered a laceration to his scalp, which required treatment. Judge Kay, speaking about the boy who was knocked unconscious, said, "This was a cowardly, aggressive, violent attack in full view of very many other young people. This was a joint attack by a number of people involved in the punching and kicking. The victim has continued to suffer from the mental effects of being assaulted in such a violent way. He also feels guilty because his cousin was stabbed when that was probably intended for him. You worked in numbers because that's how cowards work." The judge told the court that the defendant was assessed to be at high risk of reoffending and expressed doubt that the letter he wrote was genuinely remorseful. The offender was sentenced to 12 months in prison and must serve at least 6 months before being considered for release. Judge Kay said, "The message of all this is, if you behave in this manner, you will receive a custodial sentence. The teenager who stabbed the other victim is due to be sentenced on January 25th. St Albans Chief Inspector Linda Coates said, "The stabbing victim was lucky to survive this horrendous and violent attack, and no doubt the traumatic events of that day will stay with both of the young victims and their families for the rest of their lives. The domino effect of violent crime is far-reaching, and these serious convictions will stay with the teenage offenders for the rest of their lives. Their own families will have also suffered the heartache of seeing their loved ones go through the criminal justice system, stand trial, and be sentenced."
It is despicable. That's how a 10-year-old writes to Theresa May about increasing rubbish in forests. Margaret Wicks Primary School pupil Lily Rose Gruber noticed how much rubbish was being dumped in St Albans woodlands when walking through Batchwood Estate with her mother, Catherine Higgs. Picking up enough discarded waste to more than fill a whole bin bag, Lily Rose determined to flag this up to the highest authority in the land. Drafting the words for more than a week, she wrote, "Dear Theresa May, I'm writing to you on behalf of our wildlife. I've noticed a huge amount of plastic waste on the floor of our forest. I feel strongly that this is despicable, because poor little animals could pick up parts of plastic packaging items, such as bottle caps, to feed to their young." She stresses, "We should treat our landmarks with care and consideration to ensure that we keep these species from extinction." And she is asking St Albans District Council to install more bins around green spaces. Just 2 weeks later, Lily Rose received a reply from the Prime Minister. It said, "It was very good of you to get in touch with your concerns about plastic litter on forest wildlife and for taking the time and trouble to share your thoughts and suggestions on this important matter. The letter has been forwarded to the Department of the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs and the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government." Catherine said she was really proud. She's like a little eco-warrior. She's taken it really seriously and she's not letting it go. So good luck, St Albans District Council. Lily Rose was chuffed with the reply, Catherine said. She kept saying, "They haven't written back." And I told her, "Well, they're busy with Brexit." I think she wants people to be more aware of the impact rubbish has on the environment. Portfolio holder for the environment at St Albans District Council, Councillor Frances Leonard, said, "Lily Rose is clearly a very determined and resourceful young person who has a passion for the environment and the outdoor life. I would be happy to meet her to discuss her request for more bins, as well as the need to campaign against litter and fly tips, which can be such a blight on the landscape. We always welcome feedback from our residents, whatever their age, and we are open to suggestions about where bins are best placed. And there's a photograph of Lily Rose walking in the park looking for rubbish, and also a photograph of her letter to Theresa May, which is in very nice joined-up handwriting, and a photocopy of the letter that she received from Number 10 Downing Street.
Queen recognises people who have served UK in a variety of different ways. More extraordinary people from St Albans have been recognised in the Queen's New Year's Honours 2019. Nearly 1,150 people received an award from Her Majesty this year, including St Albans man Ian Martin Pittaway, who is the chairman of the Robert Clack Development Trust. This is a charity set up by the alumni of Robert Clack School, where Ian attended until 1974. Through fundraising and mentoring schemes, the 1,500-strong organisation support and inspire pupils currently attending Robert Clack. Ian went on to study law at Hull University and is now a senior partner at Sackers, a law firm in the City of London. He received a British Empire Medal, BEM, for services to the community in the London borough of Barking and Dagenham. The 62-year-old said, "Our motto is that you never really leave Robert Clack. You may physically leave, but you have a duty to give back to the next generation." Many of us went on to have successful careers, like medics, lawyers, or journalists, and we want to give them, current pupils that is, a leg up too. For example, the charity will pay for university open day travel expenses if required. He added that the award is not just for him, but a recognition of everyone's hard work. St Albans Commander Michael Goldthorpe also received a BEM for services to naval personnel. He is the Chief Executive of the Association of Royal Navy Officers, the membership organisation for all Royal Navy, Royal Marines and Queen Alexandra's Royal Naval Nursing Service officers. He was born and schooled in Yorkshire, joining the Royal Navy as a writer in 1978. During his career, he served on a number of ships and onshore in Muscat, Yeovil, Gibraltar and at the Ministry of Defence in London. Michael retired in 2010 to the rank of commander. A St Albans cave diver, Vernon Unsworth, has also been awarded a Member of the Order of the British Empire, MBE, for services overseas. He helped to save 12 boys and their football coach from a flooded Thai cave in July by mapping out the complex Tam Luang tunnels.
A Kimpton grandfather was shocked to receive a British Empire Medal for his services to the community. The honour has been bestowed upon Andrew Morton as part of the New Year Honours. He told this newspaper, "I feel rather shocked. Kimpton is such a friendly place with so much going on. There are so many people who deserve this medal just as much, if not more than I do. I just think of myself as a representative of all that goes on in the village and just feel incredibly proud that I can represent the village in that way." During his working years, Mr. Morton was a secondary school teacher at Onslow St. Audrey's in Hatfield, Townsend in St Albans and Heathcote in Stevenage. His BEM, however, is in recognition of his dedication to Kimpton Primary School. In his previous role as Governor, now Associate Governor, he was the Chairman of the Curriculum and Community Committee. He also supported the head teacher on the recruitment and interview panel. He is a lay reader and formerly a lay minister for the Church of Kimpton, and he has also led the whole school celebrations for Harvest Festival. The 69-year-old set up a Kimpton food box, which the school donated to each month to support the families in the parish. This took place over the course of a year. Aware of many village residents feeling isolated, Mr. Morton initiated a community lunch to bring people together in companionship. It attracted 34 participants and was further enriched by his organising school children's visits, helping to create intergenerational dialogue and understanding. When a major flood struck Kimpton in February 2001, the father of one coordinated sandbag volunteers, attended multi-agency meetings on behalf of those threatened, and produced a newsletter. He was integral to the Noise Project, held each July, when up to 50 volunteers from across the parish undertake gardening, hedging, fencing, painting, grass cutting, and any other DIY tasks. This work is completed on behalf of those less able to undertake them. Mr. Morton, who has lived in Kimpton since 1977, said, "Kimpton is a lovely place to live. It's so friendly and welcoming." For many years, Mr. Morton has also run the very successful Kimpton Yacht Club. And there's a lovely photograph of Mr. Morton and his wife, Juliet, smiling and obviously feeling very proud to have received his BEM.
The headline for this article is "New Playground Opened After 12-Year-Old Leads Campaign." A schoolgirl has successfully lobbied and fundraised for new playground equipment in Colney Heath. In September 2017, then 11-year-old Indiana Mae Evans set her mind to improving the facilities at Rostock Park, setting the wheels in motion by sending a strongly worded letter to Colney Heath Parish Council. She described the play area as disgusting, rusty, boring, uncared for and overgrown, calling youngsters living in the village the forgotten children. Following her plea, the project was allocated £20,000 from Tarmac and £4,000 from Colney Heath Parish Council, raised from the Grange Development S106 funds. The parish council also agreed to match any money Indiana could raise herself and install a piece of equipment of her choosing. She collected £1,000 and picked a supernova ring. Work on the multi-use games area began in June this year and was finished in October. Indiana was invited to the official opening ceremony last month. Parish councillors Derek Crump and Cecilia Hathaway also attended the launch. Indiana said, "I feel very proud of myself, but I'm still going to work on it because in the summer when I went to the park, lots of people were asking me to get a zip line. It will be a challenge, but I'm still passionate about it." She would like to be a politician when she's older, having attended the Conservative Party conference in October. "It was really great, really interesting to see what was going on." Indiana encouraged her peers to get involved, even if they're unsure, because it's very important that strong-minded people can work in politics. The now 12-year-old's mum, Jane Evans, said, "I feel proud of Indiana because so many people see problems and just moan and complain and expect others to do something about it. But she saw the problem and tried to sort a solution, and I think that's really mature of her. I imagine they were wondering what to do with the park. It was on their radar, and Indiana moved the hands a bit." Jane said, "Children now have somewhere to play football, go on their bikes, and congregate safely." Colney Heath Parish Council thanked Indiana, Tarmac, and Groundwork Hertfordshire, who project managed the build. And there's a photograph of Indiana smiling broadly and flanked by parish councillors Derek Crump and Celia Hathaway at the reopening of Rostock Park.
And now, children from Harpenden have set the trend for a volunteer police scheme set up to build trust in the community. Hertfordshire Police have announced that the mini police scheme has enjoyed a successful first term after it was trialled for 8 weeks in Harpenden in April. It sees youngsters between 9 and 11 supporting officers at community events and taking part in sessions on road safety, staying safe online, and antisocial behaviour, led by local officers and police community support officers. It has been rolled out to 14 schools across the county, including Bishop Stortford, Hemel Hempstead, Letchworth, Waltham Cross, Stevenage, Radlett, Bushy and St Albans. It received funding from the Police and Crime Commissioner David Lloyd. Community Safety Officer Gail Franklin, who coordinates the mini police scheme, said, "I've been really pleased with how the scheme has been welcomed by our officers across the county, and the feedback from schools has been fantastic. The children have learned new skills and valuable advice, as well as having the opportunity to devise projects which benefit their local communities." And there's a photograph of a police car surrounded by small children in mini police uniforms. They're wearing black nylon jackets with police written on the armband and yellow fluorescent waistcoats. And they all look super happy.
This next item asks, is film further proof of a big cat on the prowl in the district? A woman believes she has caught video footage of a big cat wandering around St Albans city centre. Sarah, who would prefer to only use her first name, spotted a strange animal run in front of her car as she drove along Hall Place Gardens on Saturday, December the 29th. Chalking it up to dim lighting, Sarah was trying to turn around when it ran out into the road a second and third time. This gave Sarah enough time to whip out her phone and snap some film. She said, "As I looked to my left, there was this big animal that was really strange looking. It was grey, had a really long tail, and was the size of a small dog. But it definitely wasn't a dog. The tail was skinny and it moved like a cat. She thinks it looked disorientated and confused, but that it could still scare unwitting pedestrians by walking brazenly around the city centre." Adding, "It was crazy. If I hadn't taken the picture, I wouldn't have believed it myself. But I know what I saw." This is the second video which claims to prove the existence of a big feline around the district. In June 2017, taxi driver Jaheed Chowdhury had finished a shift and was driving home along Knapsbury Lane at about 4:30 a.m. when he caught an animal on his dashcam. Realising what he thinks he had seen, Jaheed went home and called the police. He said, "I have seen lots of big deers and foxes, but this is the wildest animal I have ever seen." However, after it was published on the Hearts ad, many residents dismissed the film as simply showing a large house cat. Heated debate erupts every time an eyewitness reports seeing the big cat. For example, when a dog walker found half a mutilated deer in April 2018, or when large feline footprints were preserved leading through a golf bunker after a night of rain in June 2018. In January 2017, two Oaklands College staff members saw a large sandy-coloured cat. Scratch marks were found on a tree after a huge animal was seen near Welland, and a big black cat was spotted by Luton Airport last year. A Freedom of Information request in November 2016 revealed that Hearts Police received about 30 big cat reports in the 5 years previous.
Nothing about big cats, but this piece is about a Harpenden charity shop encouraging people to donate their unwanted Christmas gifts. Age UK Harpenden in Harding Parade is urging people to give back any unwanted presents, whether they are novelty jumpers, books that have been read, duplicate gadgets or bath products that will never be used. The shop is accepting donations of both new and second-hand items, which will then be sold on to help fund the charity's work helping vulnerable older people. The charity is also urging people to make the donations worth an extra 25% by signing up to Gift Aid. This means Age UK will receive an extra 25 pence from the government for every pound raised from donations. The Harpenden shop manager, Alison Matthews, said, "It can be difficult knowing what to do with gifts that will never be used. However, by donating unwanted Christmas presents or old items to our shop, people will be helping a great cause. Not only could they be another person's treasure, your donations will also help Age UK raise much-needed funds to help brighten up 2019 for an older person."
This article tells us of a fruit expert who has launched an app to help buyers pick the tastiest crop using nature's seasons. A St Albans fruit expert is going bananas for the best and tastiest fresh produce in his popular blog and new mobile app. Although Nick Ball started the Good Fruit Guide 6 years ago to help consumers buy fresh harvests at their seasonal best, he's just launched an accompanying app. With a new upload every 2 weeks, Nick recommends the best variety of fruit to suit seasonal changes. "It's something I'm particularly passionate about because I've spent my career in the fruit business and I would like to try and help people to see fruit in a different way." The former entomologist says consumers are losing touch with the seasons because most fruit are on the shelves all year. He believes tastier products would encourage healthier eating. "If people were to buy more fruit with flavour, they would enjoy fruit more thoroughly." Although now retired, Nick has worked for major supermarkets such as Tesco, Sainsbury's and Morrison's. Last month, he appeared on BBC's The One Show in a festive feature about easy peeler oranges that are traditionally put in stockings. In the interview, Nick said, "The main clementine at the moment is called the clemenules, and that's a very good clementine. They're easy to peel, they're sweet, and that's very attractive to people. Right now, we're in the middle of the Mediterranean citrus season, and after Christmas, we'll move into the late season fruit, which is the Nadelcott clementine." Nick has lived in St Albans with his family for 26 years. He said his fruit expertise comes from his childhood in Kenya and years working in the fresh produce industry. Nick describes his blog as, "The purpose of the Good Fruit Guide is to highlight which are the fabulous tasting fruit from around the world, the sort of fruit that you can't stop eating. In helping you find that fruit when it's available, you can buy the most flavoursome available. Enjoy it, eat more and waste less."
And now athletics. Two of St Albans Striders' rising stars rounded off a great 2018 with strong performances on the final weekend of the year. James Moore, aged 15, finished his first half marathon at the Lee Valley Velo Park in a time of 1 hour, 22 minutes and 58 seconds to finish 6th overall. Meanwhile, Will Auron, aged 17, was the third senior finisher and 7th overall at the Buntingford year-end race, a 10-mile race. Many striders competed in festive park runs on Christmas morning. Most notable was Jenny Maddox, who finished first female on the undulating course at Tring. Laura Lane completed the 50-kilometre Winter Cross Ultra, which takes place in part of the South Downs Way. On Sunday, Lawrence Dine completed his goal to run 2018 miles in 2018. He achieved his feat in aid of Reverse Rett, a charity dedicating to changing the lives of children and adults with Rett syndrome.
The final article describes how a charity rugby union game brought more smiles to grassroots players in St Albans, as well as raising plenty of money. The match brings together players from Old Albanian, St Albans and host club Verulamians, and this year there was a contingent from Berkhamsted too, with proceeds raised going to Help for Heroes. The match saw a youthful Verulamian side take on a much more senior Everybody Else side. Mick O'Shea, who helped organise the contest, said, "Thank you to everyone who pulled on a pair of boots and played in the charity rugby game at OVs. V's, OA's, Berkhamsted and St Albans were represented admirably, and a very entertaining 80 minutes of rugby was had. Pacey running saw some great tries scored by the V's, but they had to contend with real up-the-jumper stuff from the 8 front-row players who made up the opposition pack. Plenty of tries and a well-refereed match meant a good day was had by all.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly nature notes for the Hearts Advertiser. Watching nature watch. As a bird watcher, I am used to watching. I like to think that I have honed the art such that not much avian life escapes my notice. Combined with a good set of ears, my walks are walks of watchfulness, looking and listening as a hunter would for nature's never-ending bounty of sights and sounds. But there are times, too, when I sense I, too, am being watched. If I thought my senses were fine-tuned, there are others in the wild whose powers of perception go way beyond what I could hope for. Yes, binoculars give me an advantage, allowing me unnaturally close-up views from a distance, but often I have been spotted or heard before I even started looking. Scanning an old oak tree yesterday, and the two eyes of my binocular lenses were met suddenly with the equally cold stare of a little owl. He had been there all along, a dumpy ball of feathers, enduring the cold and watching me all the while. Did his heartbeat quicken, I wonder, as I approached? Or was he not worried about my presence and maybe instead a little bit annoyed that I was disturbing his daydreaming? Either way, he didn't show it, but those yellow eyes continued to follow me, unblinking, until I had passed by. Having been a watcher all my life, I have noticed just how much time is spent watching and waiting by wildlife. Long periods of the day can pass with no apparent activity, or even movement, but at some point activity resumes, either to look for food or to avoid becoming food. Sometimes this waiting allows the performing of maintenance tasks. I recently watched a peregrine falcon preen its feathers and dry off after a quick dip in the nearby gravel pit. Without this regular bath, the falcon's feathers would become congealed with the blood of its suppers. It is the assassin's clean-up. At other times, the inactivity is simply to rest, but this is never uncoupled from watchfulness. For us, as humans, sleep is by and large an on-off thing. We're either awake or fast asleep. But for birds and a few other creatures, the ability to half-sleep is a scientifically established phenomenon. Known as unihemispheric slow-wave sleep, the brains of birds and some aquatic mammals, such as whales and dolphins, have been shown to be able to operate in two halves. One half of their brain is awake, including an open eye, and the other half shows the electrical signatures of sleep. This appears to be a protective mechanism, enabling the animal to fly or swim and monitor its environment for threats with one hemisphere while the other gets some rest. More recently, this kind of half-wake vigilance has been shown to extend to humans too. Tests on volunteers sleeping in an unfamiliar environment showed that one half of their brains remained more active or vigilant during their first night of sleep. Once the environment had become more familiar, so their sleep deepened on subsequent nights. This ability to half switch off has obvious benefits to wildlife, allowing them a secure but not deep sleep. But it is perhaps more stressful to the tired human traveller wanting a good night's sleep on arrival. I do, however, believe that I may have perfected the technique to my advantage during some long lectures at university. Watching the watchers undoubtedly brings a greater affinity between the wild watched and the human watcher. Not only is an insight into the lives of the birds or animals watched gleaned, but also a sense of what they are watching too. A sudden alertness amongst the ducks and gulls heralds the end of the peregrine's snooze. The tilted head of a wader, eye to the sky, signals the arrival of a buzzard overhead, and a change in call note of the feeding pied wagtail suggests that somewhere out in the distant ether, a sparrowhawk is peeling off in a lethal stoop. Of course, it is not always threat that concerns wildlife. After a particularly stormy period of weather, I took my dog out for a walk. The wind had gone, the skies had cleared, and the sun sat low, bathing everything in a soft and welcome warm light. It was a moment to breathe and take in the beauty, and I was not alone. Perched magnificently in the top of a dead tree sat two red kites, their rusty tones glowing in the winter sun. A little way off, a lone buzzard also sat soaking up the rays. A sense of contentment conjoined the watcher and the watched, and all was well in that moment.
Right, this is Peter Burley, your arts and events previewer, starting another year. 2019 beckons. Well, I hope you're all recovered from the excesses of Christmas. We've got plenty on in the new year, although I must say a lot of people do seem to be resting for the first couple of weeks of a new year. In our period, which is mid-January to mid-February, there's nothing on at the Organ Theatre, although it's obviously open as usual to the public, and sadly St Peter's Church hasn't yet posted any of their concerts, so there are a couple of gaps. However, we've got a very full programme now of Hearts Jazz. Those of you who are jazz fans, the move of the Hearts Jazz Club to the Maltings has brought a feast of music for you. We've actually got five concerts in our period. On the 15th of January, we have Alan Barnes Quintet. 22nd of January, the Neil Angeli Trio. 29th of January, the Jam Experiment. And this isn't cooking, this is a concert. 5th of February, we have Clark Tracy doing a thing called Birthday Gig. And on the 12th of February, we have Ari Hernig Trio performing. Now, the times, etc., etc. Doors open at 7 p.m. for all those concerts. They all start at 7:30 and finish at around 10 o'clock. If you buy in advance, tickets are £13 or concessionary tickets £12. On the night, it's £15 or £14. Now, carrying on at the Maltings, sorry, I should have said all those concerts are in the Maltings. And still in the Maltings, we have the first of our folk season of the year concerts, and that's on February the 1st. It's Alison Frosdick and Jack Burnaby, and they create the ambiance of music halls, country fairs and horse-drawn caravans. An interesting musical thought, that one. That concert starts at 8 p.m. Tickets are £12 or £11. Now let's move across to the cathedral, and we have the first of our organ, we have two organ lunchtime organ concerts in our period. 16th of January, we have Timothy Easter, who's come all the way from Harpenden to play for you. And on the 13th, we have Jonathan Lee, who's come from Berkhamsted Parish Church to play for us. Now, the concerts take place at 12:30 p.m. They're in the Crossing, and there is a retiring collection. Now, also in the cathedral, on Saturday the 19th of January, and this is in the International Organ Festival series of concerts, on the 19th of January at 5:30 p.m, we have a concert by Colin Walsh, and he'll be playing music by Dupré, Saint-Saëns, Franck, Giroufflet, Vienne, Lethèse, and Henri Mullet. Right, and again, the same thing there. It's free, but with a retiring collection. Now, the big event at the cathedral, however, and there's only one big musical event, is a thing called the Big Sing Festival. And this takes place on Saturday, the 26th of January. And it's an all-day event if you want to participate. if you want to participate, you turn up not at the cathedral, but at the Walpole Road Methodist Church at 11 in the morning, where rehearsals start. Then you have a break, or by the way, you're advised to bring your own lunch if you're going to take part in the rehearsals. Otherwise, it's going to be a long, hungry day. Right, then the actual performance in the cathedral is at 6:30 in the evening. Now, you actually have to pay to take part in the rehearsal, but the price if you just go to the concert is under 16s are free, but you have to get a ticket, and adults are £8. There are some refreshments provided, and I also haven't said it's what the music is. It's it says here, be part of an amazing opportunity to sing jazz, pop and soul music in the magnificent setting of St Albans Cathedral. So a rather different concert to their usual ones. Now let's round off in the cathedral with two non-musical events. Well, actually, one of them isn't entirely non-musical. They're both talks, but the first talk is on Wednesday the 30th of January, and it's entitled Franz Liszt, Life, Music and Franciscan Faith. And it is a talk about Liszt and his religion, but illustrated by his music. There was a pianist performing there to support the speaker, and that's going to be in the nave of the cathedral. It starts at 7:30 p.m. and the price is only one price, is £12.50, but that does include an interval drink. And then we have on Friday the 8th of February a poetry evening on the theme of war and peace, and that's going to be in the chapter room in the deanery. That'll also be 7:30 to 9 p.m. The price is £10 and appear to be no interval and no drink. Now, last musical event, sort of freestanding, is on Saturday the 9th of February at 7:30 p.m. in St Peter's Church, and it's performed by Carillon, and it's going to be called Songs of Chaos and Eternal Night. For some extraordinary reason, recent political developments came to mind with that title. So that's on the 9th of February, and I haven't unfortunately got the ticket price for that. Let's go across now to the Alban Arena, and the first concert we've got is on Thursday the 17th of January at 7:30 p.m. and it's called the Estefan Experience, subtitled Rhythm Is Gonna Get You. And it is a tribute show to the singer Gloria Estefan. All tickets are £23.50. Now, the second concert is also a tribute concert, ABBA Forever. I don't think you need much explanation of what that's going to sound like. On Friday the 18th of January, 8 p.m, all tickets also £23.50. Then on Sunday the 20th of January, have a remarkable performance by the Zombies, who are, of course, our big local band, started their life in the Pioneer Club on Bernard's Heath. And they're coming back on the 20th of January at 7:30 p.m, all tickets £25. And there's a sort of tribute here to Jim Rodford, who died last year, who was, of course, a founder member of the band. Then we have the Classic Rock Show on Tuesday the 22nd of January, 7:30 p.m. Tickets for that are £34.50 or £24.50. And this will be anthem after anthem after anthem, it promises. Then we have Swinging at the Cotton Club, featuring the Lindy Hop Dance Company and the Harry Strutters Hot Rhythm Orchestra. And this will take you back to the 1920s and 1930s style of music in New York. That's on Thursday the 24th of January, 7:30 p.m. All tickets £22.50. Then we have an annual fixture of the Royal Marines Band concert. And this year that's on Friday the 25th of January at 7:30 p.m. Tickets for that are £27 or £24. And we have another tribute concert coming up on Saturday the 26th of January. And again, it'll be on the 8th of March. Now, the January one, it says, is sold out. So if you're a big fan of this music, you might want to make a note of a date, 8th of March, for a reprise of the concert. And the concert is called a Luther Vandross Celebration. And all tickets for that on both nights are £22.50. And then we have Think Floyd, yet another tribute band. And you'll be Thinking Floyd on Thursday the 31st of January at 7:30 p.m, all tickets £24.50. And we have the Chicago Blues Brothers, who are on a Motown mission. That's on Friday the 1st of February at 7:30 p.m, all tickets £23.50. Now, here's one we'll put in our diary, a Prosecco and Gin event. I think the idea, by the way, is you drink them separately, not that it's a rather unexpected cocktail. So it's a Prosecco and Gin event, which is on Saturday the 2nd of February. It starts at 1 in the afternoon and has an afternoon session through to 5. And they obviously clear up all the mess and reopen at 6:30 p.m. and finish at 10:30 p.m. Tickets are £15.50, which includes a free drinks token worth £5. And it's just basically sampling the two sorts of drinks, presumably in lots of variations. Moving from unhealthy to healthy, Trust Fast Health is a one-man show by Michael Mosley, the television doctor and presenter, and he'll be talking about diets and the unconventional journey he has taken through medicine. And that's on Wednesday the 6th of February at 6:30pm. Tickets are £23.50 or £21.50. Then on Thursday the 7th of February at 8pm, we have a show called Horn Section, and this has been a sellout show at the Edinburgh Festival, and it's a spectacular performance with outlandish musical talent led by the comedian Alex Horn. All tickets £16. Then we have a Forbidden Nights, so you won't be allowed to go. That's on Friday the 8th of February at 7:30pm, and this is a brand new show with acts and routines. It's a Chippendale themed show. Tickets are £24.50 for the first five rows, cheaper as you work back. And the last event I've got for you is on Wednesday the 13th, running through to Friday the 15th of February, and it's the St Albans Gang Show. Tickets are only available from the gang show or from the box office, so you can't turn up on the night. Now, the performances are 7:30pm every evening, and then on Saturday the 16th, there is a matinee at 2:30 and an evening performance again at 7:30, and tickets are £7 up to £14. So we will now press on to the Harpenden Public Halls, and they also have a gang show. Now, I should have done this last month, but the publicity wasn't published, so I will slip it in, even though it's a bit tight on the timing. The Harpenden Gang Show runs from Tuesday the 8th of January through to Saturday the 12th of January. It's going to be obviously in the show. It's at 7:15 each evening, except for a 2:15 performance at that's in the afternoon, on the 12th of January. It lasts through to 9:45pm on the evening performances and 4:45pm on the matinee. Now, one which is in time, I'm determined to get to this one this year, the Brambleton Model Railway Club annual indoor exhibition, because they have outdoor events at their track outside at the Highfield Oval. Now, that's going to be on Saturday the 19th of January. It's 10am to 5:30pm in the public hall. Admission price is £4 or £3. And then there's quite a big event, pantomime. And they do this each year in Harpenden. They have a late pantomime for those who missed it before Christmas. And this year, the Hearst Children's Theatre Group are presenting Aladdin, and it's going to be on Thursday the 24th of January at 5pm, Friday the 25th at 7pm, Saturday the 26th at 1pm and 7pm, and Sunday the 27th at noon and then again 6pm. All tickets are £11 or concessionary tickets £8. Now let's go to the Abbey Theatre, and we have two plays. Unfortunately, neither says if there is an audio description production, so there may or may not be. You'd need to make an inquiry if you want to book. Now the first play is called Silly Cow, and it's written by Ben Elton, and it's performed by the Company of Ten. And originally it starred Dawn French and was a West End sellout. And it's about, it's a sort of same sort of lifestyle as Ab Fab. So be prepared for a slightly raunchy evening. Now, that's running from the 18th to the 19th and then the 22nd to the 26th of January. There are performances at 8pm on all those days, and there's a Sunday matinee at 2:30pm on the 20th of January. And tickets are £12 or £11. Then we have second play is called A Beautiful Thing. It's a gentle and hugely optimistic play. Two teenagers are next door neighbours in Thamesmead Estate, and it's a story about their relationship underscored by a Mama Cass soundtrack. Perfectly captures the wonder of first love, but the play does contain mature language. So that runs on Friday the 8th to Saturday the 9th at 8pm, Sunday the 10th, matinee at 2:30pm, and then Tuesday the 12th to Saturday the 16th, it says here of September, but I suspect that's February, at 8pm. Tickets are £12 or £11. Now, I couldn't find anything on at the museum, but a reminder that every Wednesday is still the Spotlight Talks at 1pm. are the St Albans and Hertfordshire Architectural and Archaeological Society is hitting the ground running with its lecture programme. And the first one is on Tuesday, the 15th of January. And don't forget, all lectures are now on Tuesdays and they're all in Marlborough Road Methodist Church. And this is going to be on the London Mithraeum and the new home for the Temple of Mithras. And that's talks being delivered by Louise Fowler. Now, we actually went to the Mithraeum last year. It is superb and it's well worth hearing about. The speaker comes from the Museum of London. All lectures are 7:45. I think I forgot to add that. Tuesday the 22nd of January, we have Hugh Middleton and the New River, and it's a talk by Helen Gibson. And this is this amazing 17th century engineering project to take a water supply for London from near Ware right down into the current, right down to Islington. And it's a fascinating project. Then on Tuesday the 5th of February, we have Hitler's British Isles. And this is given by Duncan Barrett. And it's a speculation about what it would have been like had Britain been invaded by the Germans in 1940. And finally, on Tuesday, the 12th of February, we have the rise and fall of the pubs of Wheatamstead. And this is from 1830 to 1914. And it's been given by Patrick McNeil and Peter Jeffries, who are two expert local historians from Wheatamstead. Now, I have heard a very abridged version of this talk, and I can highly recommend it. It's a very interesting talk about building, social history, economic development. I mean, it pulls in far more than people just drinking pints of beer. And I will give you one curtain-raising highlight. Unbelievably, in this period, there were 7 pubs in Gusted Wood, which now has 1. 7 pubs, if you know Gusted Wood? Where did you put them all? But he'll tell you. Now, 2 seasonal events coming up. We have Burns Night on the 25th of January. A reminder to you all, stock up with haggis once you've finished the Christmas turkey. And there's actually a specific Burns Night celebration at the Peterbilt Community Centre if you want to engage with that. And the other seasonal event is that this year, and I think this is quite early, the Pancake Race, that Shrove Tuesday, falls on February the 5th, and that will be noon outside the clock tower, and they'll be running with pancakes that day. So there we are. We've gone all the way from Christmas to Easter, I think. That's quite a whirlwind tour of Christian festivals.
Joe Carter is CEO of Hearts Vision Loss. Now, the obvious thing there is, Joe, that Hearts is Hertfordshire, so you cover the whole county. Vision Loss is about visual impairment. Tell me, what does Hearts Vision Loss actually do?
We are Hearts Vision Loss. We are a Hertfordshire-based charity that supports people who have a visual impairment or who are blind. And some people may have known us as the Hertfordshire Society for the Blind, which we have been since 1915 until we changed our name a couple of years ago. So it can be people that have any degree of sight loss across the whole of Hertfordshire. And we do that by offering a range of services. So we offer home visiting and befriending. We offer support groups. We offer counselling, employment support, advocacy services, support with information and equipment and advice. So really, nothing's too much of an ask. If somebody asks us, we will do what we can to support people.
We'll come back to the name, because that original name is quite interesting. It sort of tells you about the history of the organisation of those sorts of groups of people who are working with different things. When you say that you provide a range of services, and you just described some of them there, this presupposes that you know where the people are that you're trying to assist. How do you know where somebody is who might need your services? Do they come to you?
Well, I think the charity's quite experienced, being in existence since 1915. And we have always said that we will help anybody that lives in the Hertfordshire area. We're a Hertfordshire-based charity. We receive some funding from Hertfordshire County Council to support the people of Hertfordshire. And as a result of that, we have vision loss advisors that work in different areas of the county. And so they advertise the services inclusively for everybody across the whole of the county. And we know from our experience and from looking at other statistics provided by other organisations how many people are registered as blind or visually impaired in different parts of the county. Some of the work we do in the hospitals as well. So we'll go into the eye clinics, the low vision clinics, and we will meet people that are diagnosed or have previously been diagnosed with a sight issue. And we will know from which hospital they're in, whereabouts in the county they might be, and we will respond to that.
There's 2 issues there. One, there's a question of data protection, because you can't walk in and assume that the hospital clinic is going to give you information about somebody unless it's with their permission nowadays. The other thing is that you're talking about going out and communicating, but you're actually probably having to use print as a medium of communication for people for whom print is quite a difficult issue to deal with. I don't really quite see how you find the people. Yes, there's a register of blind or visually impaired. How do you find other people?
We take referrals from anywhere. We don't discriminate against where a referral will come from.
So it could be GPs, it could be opticians.
It is GPs. We get local GP referrals, we get optician referrals, we have referrals from schools, from colleges, and we have self-referrals as well. We also have a lot of referrals that come from Sensory Services, who are another organisation that works as part of Hertfordshire County Council. And we will have referrals that come from other charities as well. So, for example, maybe Age Concern might come across somebody that has a visual impairment or sight loss, and they will know to signpost to us.
So one of your organisation's jobs is to communicate with these intermediaries. They are the critical route for you. They encounter people who they think might benefit from some of the services you're offering.
Exactly. And the Hertfordshire County Council came up with an initiative which is Hearts Help, which is a central directory of services, really. And Hearts Help can also point and signpost people in the directions to the relevant supporting charities.
OK, you mentioned the Hertfordshire County Council a couple of times ago. Mm-hmm. Not actually part of that, but you're co-funded, if you like. Is that the way to put it?
We have a contract that we provide to the County Council, and a very small part of what we do is funded from the County Council. And that is to provide home visiting and befriending, a hospital information service, and site information points, so places where people can go to get any relevant information about how to manage their sight concern or their sight loss.
Right, so you've got intermediaries that are working for you in that sense out there, and you've got organisations that are helping push people forward towards you, and you said you've got officers in each area of the county. Are they professionals? Are they qualified in particular areas? How does that work?
So we have sight loss advisors, and our sight loss advisors, we have four of them across the county, and they each look after an area of the county. So the services that each of them provide are the same in the county, and they will cross-cover and support one another. They have received sight loss awareness training, which is a training that is delivered by our eye clinic liaison officer that works within the organisation. And they will have also been on other external courses as well that have been relevant.
And are they professionals? They work full-time and they're paid?
We don't have any full-time vision loss advisors, but they are paid staff, yes.
Are they supported then by volunteers? You have another team beyond the professionals, and they're the volunteers, is that right?
Yeah, so as I spoke about a minute ago, the Hertfordshire County Council contract will help us to employ the paid staff, and the staff alongside our volunteer coordinator look to recruit volunteers across Hertfordshire to work alongside the vision loss advisors to then provide those services out in different parts of the county.
Do you have enough volunteers?
We've currently got 129, which is the most that we've ever had. However, you'll never have enough volunteers. We've still got people that are waiting to have a home visit or a befriender. And then we've got other people that might want just somebody to be a companion, go shopping with them and things like that. And we're always looking for people to support from that angle. Where the organisation could really look for some skill and expertise from volunteers is in other areas, for example, fundraising and marketing. You know, we have many volunteering opportunities available for people.
Now, you mentioned some of the services like befriending and helping people to go shopping. There are other organisations which do that, like the Good Neighbour Scheme, it's called in St Albans, and it's called different things in different places. Mm-hmm. Do you provide a service that somebody else is already providing, or is your service specifically for people with sight loss and therefore requires a different sort of approach, perhaps, than the general public?
I think it's an interesting question, because I think, yes, the nature of some of the services that are provided, for example, the home visiting, a number of organisations do provide, but I think the need is there. And if you ask each organisation, they actually can't manage the demand that they've got within their organisation. So we're not doubling up on the services. So an individual won't have two befrienders, for example, there'll just be one. But the people that we support at Hearts Vision Loss are only people in Hertfordshire who have a sight loss, you know, or who are blind.
Hertfordshire's a mix of urban and rural. Do you find that that makes any difference to the services? Do rural areas get left behind because it just simply is too difficult to reach?
No, but I do think that people will say that the biggest issue that they have in Hertfordshire is transport and access to services. We were very fortunate to be gifted a minibus from the Cloth Workers Foundation, and that minibus is there to try and help us to get people transported to various things across the county. I mean, as you know, the county is huge. So if we were to hold an event or a meal or a support group, we like to be able to say, well, actually, if you're in the Decorum area, we can get you to Welwyn Garden City. And if you're in St Albans area, we can get you to Broxbourne, that sort of thing.
So it's not just befriending and going into the homes of the people. You will actually bring them into meetings.
Exactly. Our philosophy is to decrease social isolation and loneliness, and we do that in whatever way possible. So this has been a really successful summer that we've had this year in terms of trips and outings. So we've had canal trips, trips to Brighton, various meals, blind driving, various sporting events, for example, goal ball or blind golf. And so taking people to those events and supporting them with their transportation there is great because they're getting them out of the house. They're not, you know, stuck inside the house all the time.
And are we talking about people of a whole wide range of ages? I mean, we're not. Some of those activities sound like ones very much for younger people. Mm-hmm. Do you find that you're dealing with a whole wide range of ages?
Of course, we need to think about age-appropriate activities for people. And we look after or support children and adults. So we will do activities for children and adults separately. But we will look to run activities throughout the year that will be tailored to a different range of needs. So we won't discriminate against age. And I think our youngest client at the moment is 5 or 6 years old, and our oldest is 100. So as you can see, we support people across the whole spectrum.
Is the loss of sight among young kids then becoming a significant issue? Is it? I mean, one thinks of sight loss as something that affects older people in particular because of the macular degeneration and so mm-hmm. on, those problems. But are you finding that there are, in fact, more young people?
There's no doubt about it. Sight loss is certainly going to increase and is increasing as the population ages. However, we are seeing more and more children being referred to us. We are being approached by more parents for support. So I would say that the organisation does have more children that we support now than it has ever had.
And do you go into schools as part of that process then?
So we run a schools programme where one of our vision loss advisors and a volunteer who is also somebody that has a sight loss will go to visit the schools, and they do assemblies for the children, talk about being kind, how we can support our peers who are visually impaired or blind. And we teach the children about what the charity does. And they might do some tasks like trying to butter a piece of bread with a blindfold on, you know, trying to experience what it might be like to have a sight loss. So we do that. We also will go and work with children in challenges such as the Junior Dragon's Den Apprentice, which we're working with the Wormley Primary School at the moment doing that. And then we will also offer a counselling service in the school. So our trained counsellors, which we have two, will go into the school and will work with the school and the child.
When you put all of that together, the young ones and the old, all the way across the whole spectrum, mm-hmm. how many people are you encountering? How many people do you think that you could reach?
Well, we've got over 4,000 people that are sitting on our database at the moment. So they're people that we know are living in Hertfordshire with a sight loss or who are blind, and they may be receiving any of our services or may be receiving nothing at all at the moment if it's something that they don't want at the moment. But we know that there are a lot more people across Hertfordshire that we could be reaching.
It's difficult to get hold of statistics in this area, isn't it?
It is. I think we rely on some of the statistics provided from the RNIB.
Which itself has talked of a significant increase in the number of people with serious sight loss over the next 20, 30 years.
Exactly.
And that's age-related,
yes,
probably. But it's interesting, this youth issue, isn't it? Because perhaps children are surviving difficult pregnancies, being born prematurely, whatever else. Are these some of the reasons why there are kids, perhaps more kids than there were?
I mean, I would assume so. I don't know the answer to that, but I would assume so. And I think certainly recently we've been recognised by Children in Need, who have given us some funding for the next 3 years to deliver support to young people. And I think to have a large organisation like that recognising, you know, what we do is fantastic. Yeah. And that would indicate that there are more and more children coming through with these needs.
Oh, do you think all schools are aware of your services?
We've written to every single mm-hmm. school in Hertfordshire. We've got contact with a lot of the schools in Hertfordshire. And we have, over the last 2 years, visited a lot of the schools in Hertfordshire, often more than once, to deliver the assemblies. And these are junior schools at the moment, the primary schools. So I would hope that they would know that we exist.
But if there's any teacher listening or any head teacher listening who doesn't actually know everything about you, they should be onto your website fairly quickly.
I think so. Well, just give us a call and we will happily come in and see any of those teachers. I think, you know, the County Council do provide some, you know, specialist teachers who support children with vision loss in the schools. So that area knows about us as well. So they should be giving the teachers the information about the charity and the organisation. And I think people should often think as well, it doesn't matter how bad your sight is or how good it is. You know, if you've got any sight concern, then we can support you.
You're also an information service in a sense, mm-hmm. aren't you? I mean, I've looked at your website, and you, in every area of the county, you indicate all those other organisations which might be relevant to somebody who's looking into vision loss issues.
That's right. And I mean, it's amazing when you look into the county just what is out there. There's very small blind clubs that still go on in community locations. There's blind Pilates and yoga and a variety of things that are going on all over the place tailored to visually impaired people. And we're able to provide our service users with information about other organisations that provide those services.
Going back to your name change, which was, I think, a couple of years ago, from Hertfordshire Society for the Blind, which is very much of its time, isn't it? 1915, it will have been launched. There was no welfare state. There was very little support.
Mm-hmm.
There was probably a beginnings of a register of those with serious sight loss, but not everybody would be on that because it was a financially difficult time. There was no social backup. But Hertfordshire Society would have perhaps, it almost sounds as if it was one of those group of good people getting together with local authority help, perhaps. I don't know. Do you know anything about this?
One of our trustees did a lot of work around the history of the charity, and we often go to some of our places to exhibit, and we've got a bit of a storyboard about how the charity came along, and it started off just helping one individual and then it blossomed and it grew and it grew into more. But I think the name, the Hertfordshire Society for the Blind, not only is it quite a mouthful, but actually it was felt by our service users that it discriminated because it was only for blind people, when in actual fact somebody that had a visual impairment didn't want to come to us, or they didn't think they could come because they weren't blind. And I think what really hit it home one day was one of our vision loss advisors went out to see somebody in the home, and when she said, "I'm from Hertfordshire Society for the Blind," the person got really upset to the point that she was in tears, because she knew that she was going to go blind at some point, her doctor had told her, but actually she didn't want to hear the word blind. Don't talk to me about being blind. And I think that really struck a chord with us around what do we need to do about this name. And actually we went out to our service users, asked people to come back to us with names that they thought, you know, they'd like to see the organisation named as, and it became Hearts Vision Loss.
This change from a name that has got some connotations that perhaps not everybody wanted to stay with to the current one is also a sort of reflection of the much more inclusive nature of the way we approach issues that people face.
I think it's a more modern name now. You know, I think the charity was referred to as the Society for such a long time. And I think when you actually ask people, what is a society? You know, what is that? I think that the culture was, well, actually, we're not quite sure. So we needed to move the charity forward to be more inclusive, to support a wider range of people. And that's definitely something that we've done over the last few years.
Mm. You talked about some of the money that comes to you from the Hertfordshire County Council, that specific service that you deliver on their behalf, as it were, that perhaps in the old days the county councils, you know, the local authorities used to provide. And you talked about the Junior Dragons Apprentice as a way of getting money specifically for that and the children in need. What other sources of funding have you got? Where'd you get the money from?
We are very grateful that we have a lot of supporters, but I think, you know, putting it into context, our operating costs are around £262,000 a year. And that's predominantly staff, but obviously a lot of the activities that we provide, we do have to pay for as well, and premises and things like that. And 58,000 of that is provided by the County Council. So the rest of the money that we need to find to run, we have to find through fundraising and donations. We've been very fortunate in the last few years that we've been left some very substantial legacies, which has allowed us to develop services like our counselling service. But we've also been successful in winning some really, really good bids. So Morrison's, they gave us a substantial amount of money to run children's support groups, particularly in the Welwyn Garden City area. I mentioned the Cloth Workers Foundation earlier that provided our minibus. And we've also had a number of other organisations that have provided funding. So Decorum, Community Trust, HCF, a wide range of areas that we've put in bids for and been successful in winning those.
Because bids have to be usually nowadays specific to a project. So you need to say, we want to buy a bus or something like that.
Yeah, the majority of places will specify what you can't bid for. And it normally tells you that you can't bid for operating costs, which is something that most chief executive really needs to have covered.
Yes.
Unlike a business, we start our budget setting with a sort of we haven't got anything position, and then work out our plan to how we then can deliver the service throughout the year. Legacies have been something that have really, I suppose, saved a number of charities over the years. And it's a very difficult one, because how do you appeal to people to leave a legacy? It's quite a sensitive subject. But I notice that lots of organisations are doing that at the moment. Mm-hmm. Certainly Co-op have been very good to us this year and their members. We've raised over £7,000 through the Co-op.
Community funding.
Community funding,
sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Do people have direct debits so they give so much to, each month to you?
Very few. We were talking about this in the organisation this week, because actually we have to pay to be part of Just Giving or local giving. And actually the money that we're raising through those areas actually isn't substantial at all. So we've been trying to decide whether or not it's actually worth continuing with those schemes or not. We have a few individuals that will give to us regularly each month, but actually the majority of it is through our own fundraising.
Do you have to do the fundraising, or do you have people who work with you who are expert fundraisers?
We had last year and the year before an apprentice that worked with us. She supported our fundraising, but actually that's not been a post that's continuing at the moment due to our funding restrictions. So we do our own internal fundraising. So we will hold a couple of annual events. So we'll hold curry nights twice a year and a quiz night. In fact, our next quiz night will be in March. And we try and hold them in different parts of the county so that we can be inclusive, really. But it's quite difficult. The county's huge to hold an event that everybody can get to. But we do our best.
Thank you very much.
Hello, and a warm welcome to Journey, the Thought for the Week from Torch Trust. I'm Grace Davis. I recently reread a favourite childhood book of mine. I wonder if any of you have read Anne of Green Gables. Written by Lucy Maud Montgomery and first published in 1908, it's a real classic of children's literature. And it deals with some pretty big themes. On this rereading of Anne, there was one bit in particular that really stood out to me. Anne is an orphan adopted by Marilla and Matthew Cuthbert by accident when they really wanted a boy. This extract is from Anne's first night at Green Gables, when Marilla finds out she has never said any prayers, as no one has really taught her about God, and she doesn't know how. Marilla decided that Anne's religious training must be begun at once. Plainly, there was no time to be lost. "You must say your prayers while you are under my roof, Anne." "Why, of course, if you want me to," assented Anne cheerfully. "I'd do anything to oblige you. But you'll have to tell me what to say for this once. After I get into bed, I'll imagine out a real nice prayer to say always. I believe that it will be quite interesting now that I come to think of it." "You must kneel down," said Marilla in embarrassment. Anne knelt at Marilla's knee and looked up gravely. "Why must people kneel down to pray? If I really wanted to pray, I'll tell you what I'd do. I'd go out into a great big field all alone, or into the deep, deep woods, and I'd look up into the sky, up, up, up into that lovely blue sky that looks as if there were no end to its blueness. And then I'd just feel a prayer. Well, I'm ready. What am I to say?" Now, although this notion is quite shocking to the very straight-laced Marilla, as a child it thrilled me. Still does now, actually. Why should faith be passive, quiet, done in the same way as other people do, just because that's the standard? I think I took this passage on board way more than I ever realised, because all my life I have never felt closer to God than when I'm outside in the world that He created. So pray your way, worship your way. God can still hear you. And this is my challenge to you. Have a think about when you most feel God. It might be in church, or in the woods, or on a long journey. When do you think you could feel a wordless prayer? Give it a go. Thank you for listening to Journey from Torch Trust, a Christian organisation for people at any stage of the sight loss journey. You can also tune in to Torch Trust's weekly radio programme Reflections, broadcast on Sundays, just after the 9 a.m. news on RNIB's Connect Radio, and at 4 p.m. on Premier Christian Radio. To find out more, go to torchtrust.org or telephone 0333 123 1255. Until next time, goodbye and God bless.